Welcome to the second hour's readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org. Good afternoon. This is Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas. As we enter our second hour of today's newspaper broadcast, we're going to play a press conference that the governor gave this afternoon. This audio runs 41 minutes until the feed stopped. So we will play 41 minutes of this press conference and then take you back to the local newspaper articles from today, May 5th, 2020.
Thank you all for joining with us here today. We want to cover a lot of ground. First, I will start out with an update about the numbers as they have shown up today. As of today, the total number of Texans who have been tested for COVID-19 is 427,210. The total number of people who have tested positive is 33,369. The number of active cases is 15,672. The hospitalizations confirmed are 1,888. The fatalities is 906, and the total number of people who have been tested positive for COVID-19 and who have recovered from that infectious disease is 16,791. So now for the fourth day in a row, we are increasing the number of people who have recovered from COVID-19 in relation to the number of people who still have active cases for COVID-19. Now, having more than 1,000 more people recovered than those who have tested positive. I also want to share with you the ongoing status that I have as of this morning with regard to availability of things like hospital beds. We show that there still remain more than 19,000 hospital beds available, more than 2,000 ICU beds that are available, and more than 6,600 ventilators that are available. Remember this, there was the requirement to set aside a certain percentage of hospital beds, of ICU units, of ventilators, during the early stages of our response to COVID-19 to make sure that we would have those facilities available for anybody who tests positive for COVID-19. Remember also that pursuant to my most recent executive orders, we have allowed doctors and hospitals and other healthcare providers to begin to utilize those hospital facilities for the treatment of other types of patients unrelated to COVID-19. And as a result, what you should be seeing here in the coming days and coming weeks is a decrease in those number of hospital beds that are available, because those beds and those facilities should be going to patients with other types of diseases and healthcare challenges. Remember this, and this is so incredibly important. While we have been responding to every healthcare need of those who test positive for COVID-19, there have been some who may need to be diagnosed for cancer. They may have needed to be diagnosed for heart disease or some other type of physical ailment. It is so important that anybody with any type of healthcare ailment whatsoever, especially those ailments that could be life-challenging, that they have access to the doctors, the hospitals, and the healthcare they need. And that is why it is so important that this most recent executive order unleashes the doctors, the nurses, and the hospitals to be able to provide that type of healthcare that our fellow Texans need and how they're going to have it. And we will continue to monitor these, as I will show you momentarily, why we are monitoring them so closely and why these numbers are important. One thing I want you to know is that, as you can see from numbers, including the numbers from today, the amount of testing that takes place in the state of Texas continues to ramp up. We're not quite there yet. But the number of testing continues to ramp up. Today, the total number of Texans tested was 19,000. But get this. In the past 2 weeks alone, Texas has done more than half of the total testing that's been accomplished since this pandemic began in the state of Texas. So to put it this way, from March the 1st to April the 20th, there were 190,000 people who were tested for COVID-19. Since that time, there's been well over 220,000 tested. And as a result, that is demonstrative of the rate of increase that we have going forward. In addition to that, something that you will hear more about lately, and that is one of the many reasons why testing is going up, is because the National Guard has been doing a fabulous job of crisscrossing the entire state of Texas to make sure that the more remote areas of Texas, as well as the urban areas of Texas, will be receiving testing. You're going to hear a lot of discussion today later on to provide you more detail about that, the counties large and small across the entire state that have received testing recently. Yesterday, we had one of our twice-a-week phone calls with the vice presidents, as well as with Dr. Birx, as well as with Dr. Girard. The reason why Dr. Girard is important here is because Dr. Girard is one of the people who is in charge of the testing operations taking place in the states. One of the main topics that was discussed yesterday in our phone conversation with the vice president, with Dr. Girard, with Dr. Birx, is what the federal government is doing working with the states to increase the testing that is taking place. And here's what they said. They said that they are increasing both swabs as well as other testing supplies across the country. Their goal is to test 2% of the population of each state every month. That would be approximately 600,000 Texans per month, just pursuant to this one testing regimen that is provided by the federal government. And then today, the CDC said that it will send 750,000 collection swabs to Texas between now and June the 1st. Now we can go to that data. So there's certain data that I use that I wanted to share with you so you can understand exactly what it is that I'm tracking to see how Texas is progressing. I'm showing you this data that is hinged to the date that I made the announcement to begin to open up business in Texas. So one of these lines, the middle line, is for that date. The top line is 1 week before that. The bottom line is 1 week after that. Obviously, it doesn't have today's number in there, but I wanted to show you basically what we see, not just day to day, but also what I look at week to week to see how Texas is doing. So looking at column number one, you see vertically the column of the people who are being tested. And you can see right there between April the 20th to May the 4th in that two-week time span, we more than doubled the number of people who are being tested. So that is a good thing, but it's so critically important that people understand that just the number of tests in and of themselves is not all that meaningful of information. And I'll explain more why. The next column says new tested. Those are the number of people who were tested that day. So on April the 20th, there were 7,684 tested. As of the day I made the announcement to open up business in Texas, there were about 14,496 tested. And then as of yesterday, more than 16,000, almost 17,000 people tested. Again, good progression, always an increase in those tested. Again, the number tested is important, but as a number standing alone, that number is meaningless. That number is relative only to context. And the same is true with the next number I will give you. You will see going back to April the 20th, there were 553 who tested positive. You'll see when I issued my executive order last week, it was 666. And then today, as of yesterday, 784 who tested positive. That brings us to the next column, which is one of the most important data points that we look at. And that is the percentage of the people who were tested who test positive for COVID-19. As you can see back on April the 20th, the percentage of the people who were tested who tested positive was 7.2%. Then that number went down to 4.6% on the day that we made the announcement, and 4.65% as of yesterday. Anything below 7.2% is going to be a good number. Remembering this, and that is, if you were to go back earlier in the April timeframe, you would have seen that the positivity test rate was closer to 10%. In fact, sometimes over 10%. If the positivity test rate is more than 10%, that's one of those red flags that we begin to look at. Not if it's just a one-off day of testing more than 10% positive, but if there are multiple days and a trend line begins getting us back up to a 10% positive ratio of those being tested and those being tested positive, that is a warning flag for us to keep track of. So one thing that I look at every single day is, what is the percentage rate of those who are tested who test positive? And so here's what this means when it says 4.65. What that means is that more than 93%, actually more than 95%, more than 95% of the people who are tested test negative. Know this, as you're going to hear later, we've been spending a lot of time in areas where there is a high positivity rate. It could, be at meatpacking plants. It could be at jails. It could be at senior centers, where we're going in to try to identify everybody in those settings who may have tested positive. And despite concentrating on areas where we think there may be a high level, a number of people who could test positive, the fact remains that more than 95% of the people who are tested test negative. And so we have a lot of people in this state saying, well, we need to test far more people. The fact of the matter is, there's people who are in Texas who have no symptoms whatsoever, have no need to go up to a testing site to be able to be tested. And as a result, those who are testing positive remains low. Another number that's very important in our analysis of how well the state is responding to this challenge is hospitalization rate. And you get that rate by going through these numbers. So look at hospitalizations per day. Go back to April the 20th. Obviously, it was 1,411. On the day that I made the executive order opening up Texas for business, it was 1,563. As of yesterday, it was 1,533. The fact is that if you were to go back and look at these numbers over about a month time span, you will see that those numbers, on average, are fairly the same. There will be some days when it'll be 100 or 200 more, some days where it could be 100 less. But it's been on the positive or negative side around the mid-1500 level the whole time. However, understand this important fact, and that is, over that same period of time, when the number of hospitalizations have remained on average roughly the same, the total active cases have increased. So go back to April the 20th, and you see the total number of active cases at 13,257. Then look at when I made my executive order last week, it was just a little bit more, 13,464. Then look at yesterday, when it was 15,358. So if you were to look at the total number of new positive tests, going back to the third column, you would see, well, that's an all-time high of 784. You will see that the total number of people tested was an all-time high. But you'll see that the total number of active cases was at an all-time high there. But during those highs, you actually see the hospitalization rate decline from 10.6, went back up to 11.6, now down to 10%. Actually, it was 0.998%. And so my point is this, even though we're testing more people, even though more people are testing positive, even though hospitalization numbers fluctuate, the hospitalization rate has remained steady or steadily declining. What that tells us is that Texas is fully capable of being able to manage the healthcare needs of everybody who contracts COVID-19. There has never been any evidence whatsoever that Texas either has or will be facing the types of challenges that we've seen in places like New York, New Jersey, New Orleans, or some of these other places where they were scrambling to
amass the resources that were needed to respond to COVID-19.
My point is simply this. Texans as a people, Texas healthcare providers as a group, have done a remarkably effective job of responding to COVID-19 to ensure that we minimize the impact in our state and minimize the necessity to tap into our hospitalization rates. Another thing very important, we go to this next slide, and that is the positive test rate is also declining. So we are testing more people, as I pointed out. So as a result, the number of people who test positive is going up. But importantly, the positive test rate is going down. As you can see on that slide, it since April the 15th, we cut the positive test rate in half from 15.52% to 5.76%. And that's all for that slide. As I mentioned also, the total number of recoveries has improved daily and has now surpassed the number of active COVID cases for the past 4 days. Now more than 1,000 more people have recovered from COVID, more than the number of people who have active COVID cases. Texas ranks third in the United States in the most recoveries from COVID-19. Now, it must be emphasized, the positive results that we are seeing are the result of one thing, and that is that Texans have been following guidelines about safe practices to reduce the spread of COVID-19. They've been following distancing practices. They've been wearing masks. They have been avoiding crowds, and they've been sanitizing their hands, all of the right strategies. Every single Texan has the full capability themselves to make sure they do not contract COVID-19 by practicing these very simple strategies. And it's important. It's important for this reason. Even though we have slowed the spread in the state of Texas, even though our numbers with regard to hospitalizations and those testing positive, they all look good, the fact remains this. As it stands today, there still is no cure for COVID-19. There will be cures and immunizations and medicines that can be taken for COVID-19 in the future. But between this point and the point in time when those cures and medical treatments will be available, we must find a way to bridge that divide. So we've done it by the fact that we have shown that essential businesses can operate while slowing the spread. Remember this important fact, and that is, before my executive order on April the 27th to open up businesses to begin to increase economic activity in the state of Texas, long before that, going back to the time of my essential services order, there were many essential services operating in the state of Texas, whether they be grocery stores, restaurants for carryout purposes, hardware stores, industrial manufacturing facilities, construction, all different types of activities like that. Those businesses were operational at a time while COVID-19 spread was being reduced. So we can open up business if we follow those same very strategies those businesses were using, and that's exactly what we need to do. By following those same safe strategies, we can also show that we now can have non-essential businesses operate while still containing the spread of COVID-19. Our ability to show that we can coexist with COVID-19 depends on ongoing efforts at good hygiene to continue to slow the spread. So it's up to Texans whether or not we remain open and, in fact, open up even more, or alternatively, if actions have to be taken that would lead to greater containment in certain areas. If Texans stop using the distancing strategies that they have been utilizing over the past month, they will cause an increase in COVID transmission. if that happens, it could lead to some counties having to impose stricter standards. Well, one thing I want to do today is to make some clarifications and modifications to the executive order that I issued last week. So there was one thing contained in our executive order last week that there was some uncertainty about, but it was still contained in the executive order.
And it involves funerals, memorials, and burials, and then I'm going to add to it something that was not in that executive order, and that is weddings. So for funerals, memorials, burials, and weddings, they are all treated the same as church services that have limited seating arrangements. And you'll need to go back into the guide that I issued at the time to see what those seating arrangements are for church-type gatherings. Understand this, and that is, whether it be for attending church or attending a funeral, memorial, burial, or a wedding, we strongly encourage at-risk populations to try to watch or participate remotely, remembering this very important point. And that is almost 75% of the deaths from COVID-19 in the state of Texas are a result of people contracting COVID-19 who are age 65 and older. We can go so far to reduce deaths in Texas if we do even more to protect the most vulnerable 65-year-old and older population from being exposed to COVID-19. And that requires, in part, the people in that age cohort try to remain at home if at all possible. So in addition to that, for funerals, memorials, burials, and weddings, we for the vulnerable population, we would also recommend the provider of those services to consider designating an area for the at-risk population. Additionally, the standards that are applied to churches, that apply to these types of settings, they include alternating rows, meaning skipping a row, and trying to have an area of 6 feet spacing between parties. One individual from a household may sit with another individual from a household, or I'm sorry, from another household. Otherwise, limit seating to household gatherings alone. Now, for weddings, we want to make sure that at wedding receptions, the same type of practices are used at wedding receptions as are currently used with regard to restaurants that are open. That would mean generally 25% of listed occupancy, no tables more than six, keeping seat space at least 6 feet from other tables, and maintain 6 feet separation between parties. Bottom line is, for wedding receptions, go look at what the standards are for restaurants and comply with those standards. Another clarification that I want to provide based upon the executive order that I issued last week. If you recall, there had been an executive order about being able to walk around in parks. And in that executive order, one thing that we removed from the previous order was the need to wear a mask when you're in a park. We said we highly recommend that people wear a mask, but there would be no mandate or penalty or anything like that if you failed to do so. Remembering the fundamental premise, and that is, if you wear a mask, you are ipso facto decreasing the possibility that you will be contracting COVID. That said, we want to make sure we clarify what the standard is for park-like settings. That includes the beaches, lakes, and rivers, including river rafting. All of those categories, the categories of beaches, lakes, rivers, including river rafting, are to be treated with the very same standard as parks are to be treated. So maintain at least 6 feet separation from others where possible, who are not within the same group. Groups at beaches, parks, lakes, and rivers may not exceed the greater of the number of members from a household or up to five individuals who travel together. Also, I want to provide further clarification on restaurants. So for restaurants, there was a seating capacity limitation of 25% that applies to indoor seating. It does not, however,
apply to outdoor seating. If seating is outdoors, however, the same distancing standards are required as are imposed for indoor seating. Now, in my remarks last week, I said this. I said that we wanted to see certain operations open up as soon as possible, including barbershops, hair salons, bars, and gyms. And I said at that time that we were working with our medical team and the industry to open these as soon as possible. Well, beginning that day, after I issued that executive order, we went to work that day and every day since then, working with local businesses and industry leaders in these businesses. And we are grateful that so many small business owners, for what they did in working with us, to try to hammer out some strategies that met with the approval of our medical team. With that in mind, effective May the 8th, this Friday, cosmetology salons, barbershops, hair salons, nail salons, and tanning salons are able to open. There are rules in the best policies manual that we have provided that all of these should consult. Here's a summary of some of them. One customer per stylist, unless the individual is waiting for service. You can only wait inside if they maintain social distancing of at least 6 feet from others. We recommend using an appointment system only. If allowing walk-ins, only wait inside if they can maintain a distance of 6 feet from one another. Otherwise, waiting should occur outside or in a person's vehicle. Operating stations should be limited based upon the ability to maintain 6 feet separation between the stations. And we strongly recommend for both customers and for stylists that they wear face masks. Listen, one of the apprehensions and concerns about opening up barbershops and hair salons and similar types of businesses was the fact that the people operating the business as well as the customer, they're very close to each other as that service is provided. The only safe way that you can go about providing this service while ensuring that we're doing everything possible to prevent the transmission of COVID-19 would be for both the person providing the service and the customer wearing face masks. So once again, detailed operation instructions are provided both online and in the handbook that these operations should consult before opening up their facility. And let me go back and make this point clear. Just like I said last week when issuing the executive order opening up business, this allows these types of businesses to open up. It doesn't require them to do so. So I mentioned May the 8th, this Friday, as a time when they can open up. And I understand that some may be thinking, well, there's no way I can be opened up by then. There's too much I have to do. That's completely understandable. Or they may think, well, I'm afraid about my health being exposed, and hence I don't want to open up. That's fine. No one is being required to open up. Every owner of every salon should use their own best judgment about when is it going to be best for them to safely open, whether it's May 8th or sometime after May the 8th, making sure they will be able to maintain the quality standards that are expected of them so that they are effective at preventing the spread of COVID-19. Now, we've also had the ability to work pretty much on a daily basis in talking to owners and operators of gyms and exercise facilities, finding out, you know, what strategies work, finding out the types of sanitation activities they do have and where sometimes they don't have adequate sanitation practices. And we know that these proprietors of these operations, you know, they have a need for the income, but also they have the ability to provide their service in a way that will not cause someone to contract COVID-19. As a result, we are going to allow gyms and exercise facilities to open up beginning May the 18th based upon these guidelines. Initially, they can open up to 25% capacity for the gym component. What I mean by that is that there are some type of
gym and exercise business operations where they don't do so within a gym. They may do so outside. And obviously, if you're outside, you can't have a 25% capacity because who knows exactly what that means. What you have to do is you have to maintain safe distancing practices if you're outside, making sure people are not close enough where they can transmit COVID from one person to another. As it concerns gyms, for the initial time period, until we're able to both get better strategies and get better control of COVID-19, showers and locker rooms must remain closed during this first phase. Again, detailed standards will be provided. Here are a few. All equipment must be disinfected after each use. Customers should wear gloves that cover the whole hand and fingers. So why this? Obviously, one of the reasons is when people touch their hands on a piece of equipment and then they touch their face, they could transmit the COVID-19 germ and hence contract COVID-19. Customers should wear gloves that cover the whole hands and fingers, as I mentioned. They must maintain 6 feet social distancing inside a gym. If individuals bring equipment such as a yoga mat or something like that inside a facility, it must be disinfected both before and after use. And again, there are more instructions provided online. Now, bars is another area that we want to open. We want to open because we know the customers like it, but also we want to open because we know that bar owners desperately need to open up in order for them to have some level of income, for them to pay their bills. But the fact is that we are still working on safe ways to establish safe distancing at bars. You know, to some extent, you could make an argument that a bar could be set up in the same way that a restaurant is set up, where you have just a small limitation on the number of people who sit together with safe distancing. And that could be a strategy that could be employed by some bars. But we also need to recognize kind of the very nature of a bar. And that is, it brings people close together in a closed space, in a setting that really is the type of setting that promotes the transmission of infectious diseases. So what we need to do is, just as we showed that we could work very rapidly with regard to responding to hair salons and barbershops, we want to hear from bars about the types of strategies that you can use, understanding this key point. Not all bars are the same. Some bars would be massively large and could easily set up operations that would be able to effectively employ distancing strategies. What about small bars? How would you operate that way in ways that would ensure that you are preventing the transmission of COVID-19? We need to hear details about all different types of issues like that, that we can run by our doctors, so we can make better assessments, so we can open up bars again as quickly as possible. Now, another category that I want to provide some clarification on. Before my last executive order, manufacturers were considered to be providing essential services. But there was some lack of understanding about maybe what would be categorized as non-essential manufacturers. And so we want to make sure that non-essential manufacturers have the ability to open up also. They will be allowed to open up effective May the 18th. Let me explain to you why the 18th for them as well as for gyms. The reason is, in our discussions with these manufacturers, they can't just turn it on a day's notice. It takes days in order for them to do several things. One is to get their facilities safe enough. The other is for them to be able to get their employees up and running again. But whenever you open up a business, there are ancillary businesses that also must be open, such as the sanitation component of your business, the people who will clean up the business operations, the people who will be in charge of janitorial control, all these other different things and strategies involved in how a business operates. Because they may not have the capacity to get those up and running immediately, there needs to be some time period in which they have to be able to get all their strategies in place to be prepared to open up. So they will be allowed to open up effective May the 18th with a 25% occupancy limitation with a staggered workforce, meaning that, you know, some people can come in and work during some hour period, like for 1 8-hour period, another come in for another 8-hour period, or stagger it different ways. People come in at 2-hour segments. Whatever strategies work best to make sure you're not having everybody congregate going through the same door all at the exact same time. Also, for these non-essential manufacturers, it is important they maintain 6 feet separation between individuals. If that cannot be done, they must employ social engineering controls like plexiglass between workstations. Now, also, we want to expand the businesses that can open up that are located in office buildings. They, too, will be able to open beginning May the 18th under certain circumstances. Here again, one reason behind May the 18th is because there will need to be janitorial services. There will need to be other services employed in that building. And it's going to take a while for the owners and operators of that building to be able to get all of the different types of staff that are needed up and running to be in place by the time the building opens up. So the circumstances that businesses located in office buildings would be required to meet is they can open up to the greater of either of these two numbers, either the greater of 5 employees or 25% of the workforce, provided that the employees maintain appropriate social distancing. Now listen, I'm going to transition into the next big subject area, but I want to put some context to it because it's very important for everyone in Texas to understand both where we are and where we're going. We know that as we begin the opening up process, we need to be prepared for flare-ups in certain regions. There could be outbreaks of COVID-19 and one of various different types of places, and I want you to know we are ready for that. We have teams that are organized and they have strategies in place. And actually, as we are meeting today, they're working on these very types of mitigation strategies where there is a flare-up. So these are called surge response teams that will deal with flare-ups. They're led by the Texas Division of Emergency Management, Health and Human Services Commission, as well as the Texas National Guard, the Texas Military Division. They will surge areas with elevated COVID-19 and use tactics to eliminate and reduce those flare-ups. They'll do things like provide more PPE, more testing supplies, and they will work to enhance healthcare capabilities in those areas. They will also work with local officials to put in place health and social distancing standards to contain the flare-ups. Let me give you some example of these, and then I'm going to hand it over to the team leaders where they can explain more to you. But areas that we're looking at that people know well about because we've been talking about it for the past few days are meat packing plants. There is a challenge in the panhandle because of either or several meat packing plants up there. This led to a high level of coronavirus spread in Moore County, which is just north of Potter County in Randall County. Potter and Randall is where Amarillo is located. And the county just north of Amarillo is Moore County. And people in that entire region are affected by a larger percentage spread of the coronavirus than what we're seeing in most of the other parts of the state of Texas. Hence, there is a need for a surge response team to go in there and provide all the resources that are needed to get that area under containment. Similarly, we are focused on jails and particularly senior centers. There are some senior centers in certain locations of the state that require response that we're involved in right now. We know there may be others in the future. We are prepared for the others in the future to make sure that we are responsive wherever there are flare-ups. And then there's a fourth category, and that is a category that doesn't fit with any of those other three. It could be a particular zip code. It could be an office space. It could be related to a school setting. It could be any type of setting. But because of the capabilities we now have, and we have the ability to detect these flare-up areas, we can see the data and see what is happening on a day-to-day basis to monitor this. And then we have the capability of responding to it. And I want you to know more about it. Hence, we have the team leaders in charge of that. Chief Nemkib, I'll first pass it off to you.
Thank you, Governor. Thank you for the overview. Let's go to the next slide real quick. How's that? Better get it back there. Don't want to get it too close to me. So we'll talk real quick. This is the personal protective equipment that has been distributed within the last week in Texas. This is PPE that has been bought through the strike force working out of the State Operations Center. You'll see 4.9 million masks have been bought and distributed to hospitals, first responders, now moving into private practice physicians, and starting to move into dentist office as well as nursing homes. Your face shields there, 265,000, 262,000 gloves, another 16,000 gowns, and 38,000 coveralls. Again, this is PPE bought by the state of Texas to be distributed into the private sector and the first responders. Next slide, please. This is total PPE from the beginning, 22 million masks. Now, those are N95 masks, KN95 masks, surgical masks, and then other cotton masks that we brought in. Again, distributed to our first responders, to our hospitals, to our nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and scattered out into our private practice physicians' offices. You'll see 1.8 million face shields, another 7.5 million gloves, 237,000 gowns, and another 173,000 coveralls. Next slide. FEMA has also been working hard to bring an air bridge into Texas. And what that means is you've seen the reports from FEMA, the 177 flights that have come in. The numbers here are March 1st through May 1st of distribution from the FEMA air bridge, and this is important, into the six major distributors in the private sector. So those six major distributors are distributing that to their normal customers and clients, hospitals, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, EMS first responder agencies, as well as private practice physicians. You'll see 30 million masks from the FEMA air bridge in Texas. You'll see 587,000 face shields, 769 million gloves, and another 14.3 million gowns. So overall, while we feel the supply chain is starting to refill, we know that there's still a lot of work to do. As the materials come into our warehouse, we're distributing it continuously on a daily basis around the clock. Next slide, Seth. So total distribution between what the state has done and what FEMA has done, 53 million masks, 2.4 million face shields, 777 million gloves, and 14.5 million gowns. Now, the three of us here, General Norris and HHSC Executive Commissioner Phil Wilson, are kind of going to go through these next slide together to show the unison and the partnership of what we're dealing with. So General Norris will take this next slide and talk about the Texas Military Department and the mobile test collection update.
Thanks, Chief. Currently, the Texas National Guard has 3,079 soldiers and airmen on duty right now. And as you see on this slide, currently 1,262 of those are dedicated to the mobile test collection. We've collected over 11,000, close to 12,000 specimens, and we're in 158 counties. And there's a slide down the road that'll show the counties in the next couple of days that we'll be at. We have a call center, which has been expanded from about 70 to 124 military personnel who are answering the phone. You can see the volume there, so we're getting close to 42,000 total call volumes. The call center starts at 0800 every morning. There is a wait time of about 6 minutes. We are working to get that time down. I know one day we did have it a minute 14 seconds was the wait. And then also, again, showing the by appointment only and the phone number in order to make appointments across the state for a test.
Once again, that was the press conference given today by Governor Greg Abbott of Texas. 41 minutes of audio until the audio feed was interrupted. We'll continue now with more articles from today's local newspapers from volunteers of the Recording Library of West Texas.
City confirms 90th coronavirus case from staff reports. The City of Midland Health Department is currently conducting its investigation on one new confirmed case of COVID-19 in Midland County, bringing the overall case count to 90. The 90th confirmed case is a female in her 80s who was tested by Midland Health. She is a resident at Midland Medical Lodge is currently an inpatient at Midland Memorial Hospital. The source of exposure is contact to a known case. The woman is the 36th resident from the medical lodge to be confirmed with the virus, according to information provided by the city. The health department will continue to monitor the individual in accordance with the CDC. Ector County reports 6 new coronavirus cases by J.C. Lewis, jacy.lewis@hearstnp.com. The Ector County Health Department website listed 6 new positive cases Monday, bringing the total to 84. There are 3 probable cases at this time. ECHD reported 59 have recovered. There have been 1,305 tests taken with 1,145 negative results and 76 pending results. ECHD has contacted 1,054 people during contact tracing. The drive-through testing site at the Ector County Coliseum had its first positive case. Of the 28 tests done, 27 are negative and none are pending. 144 people have called the triage center for testing. Medical Center Health System President and CEO Russell Tippin said MCH has tested 753 with 53 positive cases. MCH reported 3 new cases on Monday. MCH is treating 3 patients at the hospital. 2 are on the isolation floor and 1 is in critical care on a ventilator. They have received 686 negative tests and 11 tests are pending. There are no persons under investigation at the hospital at this time. MCH had another employee exposure, Chief Nursing Officer Kristen Timmons said. A housekeeper had tested positive. Her last day of work was April 28th. She is self-isolating at home, and all rooms she cleaned after patients had left are being checked out. Odessa Regional Medical Center President and CEO Stacy Brown said ORMC has tested 303 with 14 positive. ORMC got 1 positive test result over the weekend. This is the first positive case they have reported since April 21st. Brown said they have received 288 negative tests and 1 pending test. ORMC is not treating any coronavirus patients at this time. MISD seeks new facilities chief by Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD is looking for a chief of operations to oversee the district's facilities and operations because the person currently in that position is retiring. The job post on the district's website describes the position function purpose as direct, manage, and coordinate broad operational activities related to the planning, development, and implementation of programs and practices in support of project management, construction services, auxiliary services, and technology services. Provide counsel and assistance to other executive staff members and other divisions of the district through own departments. Actualize the goals of the Board of Trustees and the Superintendent of Schools through district-wide planning direction program initiatives, benchmarking, and continuous improvement. After 31 years with MISD, James Riggin has submitted his notice of retirement. Thus, the district is advertising the position. Major responsibilities, according to the district, include providing leadership to effectively and efficiently accomplish the capital improvement plans of the district and to direct the preparation of plans and other requirements for future bond programs. Midland ISD's bond program is part of 6 more of the 15 responsibilities. Those bond program-related responsibilities include directing and coordinating the activities of the Midland ISD bond program staff and outside consultants hired to assist MISD in the performance of a bond program. Direct the preparation of recommendations and reports related to the bond program's activities for submission to the chief officer and the superintendent of schools for inclusion in the Board of Trustees' agendas. Direct the preparation of annual budgets for MISD bond program, including the cost of Midland ISD personnel and consultants. Manage and approve expenditures for budget within the bond program. Attend various community meetings to communicate and discuss Midland ISD Board of Trustees policies and administrative procedures as they relate to the bond program. Assist in the recruitment and selection of personnel. Evaluate employee and consultants' performance. recommend appropriate personal action, along with leading transportation services, custodial services, school plant services, technology services, construction services, facility design services, and child nutrition services. This position has certain responsibilities related to any bond programs the district undertakes. The district offered in an email when asked to explain bond program. Other responsibilities of the chief of operations include attending meetings, workshops, and seminars, and other professional meetings to share techniques, practices, and procedures in business and construction management. Participate in and formalize district short and long-range planning in the areas of possible growth, expansion, and new business. Keeping abreast of technical, legislative, professional trends and developments affecting assigned organization and programs, and disseminate this information to appropriate personnel. Maintain and adhere to ethical business practices. Supervise the activities of the Construction Services Department in accordance with the district's policies and applicable local, state, and federal laws and regulations. Responsibilities include interviewing, hiring, and training employees, working with principals in the implementation of district programs, working with operations departments to ensure the functions of those departments support the instructional needs of the campus. Work with business services to ensure that legally sound and effective practices are implemented. Working with technology department to facilitate the appropriate use of technology. Develop long-range and short-range goals, objectives, and operational configurations, which lead to the improvement of administrative services that support the instructional programs. The district's pay plan lists chief operations officer as one of the four pay grade 11 positions, along with the chief academic officer, chief financial officer, and general counsel. The pay range for pay grade 11 is $147,120 to $183,487.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, May 5, 2020. WTFB has chance to provide 1 million meals. The West Texas Food Bank has a chance to raise $300,000 for Giving Tuesday now. The Silva Law Group and the Permian Basin Trial Lawyers Association made a $100,000 challenge grant, and the Juan Silva and the association also made a $100,000 donation, according to the food bank spokesman. Should the donation match be completed, the total donation of $300,000 would help the food bank provide more than 1 million meals, Executive Director Libby Campbell said in a press release. The food bank has served more than 10,000 households in the last 4 weeks, which is about 30% more than the same time last year. The nonprofit has seen more than 1,940 new clients and served more than 1,220 households through their mobile outreaches at 12 rural sites. Exxon donating sanitizer to 13 area counties. ExxonMobil will be providing 1,920 gallons of hand sanitizer for hospitals, frontline responders, and emergency management personnel in 13 West Texas counties, including Midland and Ector, according to a press release from XTO, an Exxon subsidiary. The sanitizer, for use in responding to the coronavirus, will be delivered today at the City of Odessa Purchasing Warehouse in 384 5-gallon pails, according to the release. Arts groups adjust programming. Odessa Arts, Downtown Odessa Incorporated, the Black Cultural Council of Odessa, and the Museum of the Southwest have adjusted programming changes for the month of June, according to a press release. June dates for hot summer nights have been canceled. July dates are under review. The Black Cultural Council's Juneteenth kick-off bash and Juneteenth celebration have been canceled. The summer Sunday lawn concerts at the Museum of the Southwest are being postponed until late July, early August at the earliest. Agencies providing food. This list of where to get food in Midland is provided by MSS Connections, a program of MSS made possible by the Warren Charitable Foundation. For more information, visit www.mss.org. mssconnections.org. Midland Independent School District is providing breakfast and lunch at every school to every child in Midland. MidlandISD.net/page/334-55. Boys and Girls Club. Shelf-stable weekend meals for kids available from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Fridays. 1321 South Good Street. Salvation Army of Midland. Distribution Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. More information available at 432-683-3614. 300 South Baird. Breaking Bread Soup Kitchen. Distribution Monday through Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. More information available at 432-689-2339. 410 East Florida Street. Today in Texas History. In 2009, Texas health officials confirmed the first death of a U.S. resident with swine flu. Today in History. Today's highlight. On May 5, 1961, astronaut Alan B. Shepard, Jr. became America's first space traveler as he made a 15-minute suborbital flight aboard Mercury capsule Freedom 7.
Door of Hope Thrift Store expands by moving locations, by Tony Venegas. The plan to expand the Door of Hope Thrift Store was something that Pastor Andrew Pistone had been working on for well over a year. The executive director of the nonprofit organization had worked with a realtor to find a space to expand the store's operation. That opportunity came open when the organization leased the old Beals location on 1515 East 8th Street last December, and the rest was history, as Pistone said. The opening of the new location was set for March, but delayed due to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. After weeks of waiting, Pistone was able to finally open the doors on Friday, following Governor Greg Abbott's executive order that allowed retail stores to open at a limited capacity. Through the first weekend since reopening, Pistone said he's received a lot of positive feedback. "The response has been fantastic," he said. "People can't believe how nice and spacious the new building is. One of the biggest changes to the new store is the amount of space available. The previous store was just 10,000 square feet with two checkout counters, compared to 27,500 square feet and six counters." When the organization acquired the building, Pistone said they took some time to remodel and change out the floors. The additional space was something that Pistone said the store desperately needed. "The old building where we were at down the street was very good for us, and we thank God for that," Pistone said. "It was a great start, but we were overtaken by product, and it was very hard for people to stop and check us out. An expanded store in space gives the Door of Hope more opportunity to stay open and help the community." Pistone said that most people have been abiding by the social distancing guidelines since the reopening Friday, and that it's a good chance for others to slowly work back to how they were before everything shut down. "People can go through the line much faster and have more room to shop," Pistone said. "Coming from people being locked up these last few weeks, I think it was a great venue for them to get some air. We had a very good Friday and Saturday. The store allows the Door of Hope help those who are homeless as well, and to keep payroll and maintain financial stability. The store is open Monday through Saturday from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. The ministry relies on donations from the community and is in need of household items, toys, baby items, and clothing, among other things. Cars, trucks, boats, and RVs are also accepted donations. A full list is available on the store's website. As for what happens down the line, Pistone is hoping that he can continue serving the community the best way he can. He said the organization holds additional merchandise in a warehouse located off of Murphy Street. He says the plan is to open that warehouse to the public in the future, but he did not have a set date for that yet. "This is plenty for right now," he said.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or your favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.